This is The Guardian.
Bridget Armitt here on Gadigal Land with the full story.
A short time ago, the United States military began major combat operations in Iran. Our objective is to defend the American people.
Has Donald Trump unleashed a forever war in the Middle East? Israel and the US have been launching a barrage of missile strikes on Iran, supported by a vast American armada that's been building up in the region. The strikes have killed Iran's powerful supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who's ruled since 1989. As Iran retaliated, the situation unraveled quickly, with Tehran not only firing on Israel, but several other Gulf states that have US military bases. The death toll is slowly mounting, including more than 100 children killed in Iran. In a conflict that experts say breaks international law, will these strikes usher in the regime change the US has long sought, or will it destabilize the region?
But we're doing this not for now, we're doing this for the future, and it is a noble mission.
Today, senior international correspondent Julian Borgia on a frightening new war in the Middle East. It's Monday, the 2nd of March. Hi, Julian. Thank you for joining us.
Pleasure.
Events have been moving quite rapidly since this started, but the question everyone is asking is, why would Donald Trump do this now at this moment? What's his rationale?
Well, I think everyone is guessing when it comes to looking inside Donald Trump's brain, but clearly he wanted to have a victory of some sort to talk about over Iran, and whether that was going to be a complete capitulation in nuclear negotiations or a military victory seemed to be up for either. What seems to have triggered the timing is that after a long military buildup in the region, the CIA reckoned that they knew where the supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, was going to be, and that he was going to be at a meeting with his senior defense aides on Saturday morning. And they told the Israelis about this, and it seems like the Israelis convinced him that this was an opportunity that could not be lost. And so it does seem like they were able to kill Khamenei and a fair few senior aides at the same time.
So who is driving this conflict? Is it Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu following Donald Trump, or is Netanyahu pulling Trump into this?
I mean, obviously, to some extent, because we're not privy to the private conversations, you can't say for sure, but it certainly looks like, and the reports we're getting in the US press suggest that it's the latter, that it is Benjamin Netanyahu that is at least shaping Trump's view of Iran and shaping his view of the nuclear program, of the opportunities of a military conflict and the opportunities in negotiations.
We'll get into what's happening with the war in a moment, but it is quite a shift for Donald Trump. In 2016, 10 years ago, he was saying that he was against forever wars. He called Hillary Clinton a trigger-happy hawk. Things have completely changed.
Yes, and there are also some videos of him claiming that Obama, back in the day, was about to launch a war on Iran because of low popularity and also because he didn't know how to do negotiations. This is some 10 plus years ago. But yeah, it is a reflection of how he has changed from Trump the campaigner to Trump the president.
Let's look at the conflict itself. Fighting has been going on. Ayatollah Ali Khamenei has been killed. That's a significant development. It happened relatively early on. Does that mean regime change is a foregone conclusion? How major is that event?
It's a very major event. He ruled Iran from 1989 onwards. He has been the dominant figure in that country's politics and theology for a very long time. It doesn't mean regime change, but the regime is bigger than one man. It is a whole system, and that system has kicked into gear in terms of making the preparations for replacing Khamenei. And people have been assigned posts according to a plan that was made before this war began. So that will not determine the survival of the regime. It will be more about whether they can keep control in the provinces and the small towns around a very vast country. If opposition movements, minority groups believe that it may be their time to rise up, the question is, who has the will, who has the force, who has the power to prevail?
So what does that mean in terms of the goal that seems to be in mind here for Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu of regime change? Does it seem like that's really not going to happen right now because replacements have already been named?
I think far too early to tell. Even President Trump, when he laid out the war aims, told Iranian people to stay indoors while the bombs are dropping, and then only after that to come out onto the streets and overturn their government. We don't know. No one knows what is going to happen. I mean, it's clear that when the news of Khamenei's death spread, there were a lot of celebrations in the streets around the country, but also mass mourning. And which of these two forces will prevail at this stage, especially as the whole situation has been scrambled by US and Israeli bombing? It's impossible to tell.
In terms of regime change, there isn't a precedent for airstrikes making that happen on its own, is there?
Unless you look back to Libya, they had allied NATO airstrikes, and it was, you know, ultimately a mob who tracked down Muammar Gaddafi and killed him. And maybe that is the template that Trump is looking at, but it's not a very good template because Libya collapsed into anarchy. But maybe a Iran in chaos, Iran in anarchy, is acceptable to Trump and Netanyahu, or preferable to the current regime.
Let's take a look at some of the regional response. Iran has been striking Gulf states that have US military bases. What has been the response from Gulf states, NATO, Europe, any of those others who say that they weren't consulted about this?
Well, the Gulf states are furious that they've been targeted. They see it as an indiscriminate reaction from Iran to maybe aim at bases in their countries, but they've hit hotels and airports and really cut off those countries' links with the outside world by really damaging their airports. So they are not happy, with the exception of we're hearing of Saudi Arabia. There are reports in the US that Mohammed bin Salman privately was egging on Trump and helping Netanyahu convince him to launch this attack. That's what we're hearing. As for the other Gulf states, there is no evidence that they were in some way complicit in the planning of this attack, but they are receiving a lot of the blowback. Europe has tried to position itself in as neutral a way as it possibly can, appealing for the respective international law, while at the same time recalling what a terrible regime the Islamic Republic has been.
It's been striking. Australia's Prime Minister has said he supports this action, but it's quite a quiet voice. Do you think as the conflict goes on, we might see Europe and the UK and NATO inevitably offer some sort of support?
It really depends, I think, in what ways that Iran responds, what it attacks. I mean, apparently, according to the UK Defence Ministry, a missile landed within a few hundred yards of British troops in Cyprus. So it really depends where the missiles land, to what extent European countries will get involved in the defence of Israel, as they did in last June, as in a purely defensive role. So there are a lot of moving parts, a lot of variable factors that will determine to what extent European countries in particular are pulled into this.
It is astonishing how quickly, how rapidly things escalated because Iran chose to hit the Gulf states. At the moment, is it looking to you like a regional conflict?
I wouldn't call it that yet, in that those Gulf states have not got involved themselves. What we are seeing, though, is the Strait of Hormuz seizing up because of attacks on tankers, reports of two or maybe three attacks on tankers.
On oil tankers.
Oil tankers and LNG tankers coming out of the Gulf, which has left a lot of the shipping companies ordering their ships, their vessels to anchor and stay in place and not to go through the strait. So the tremors from this conflict, you know, expand over the region and obviously have an impact on the global economy.
Julian, what is the legal standing of a war like this? The fact that the UN wasn't consulted, that it was very much a go-it-alone between Israel and the US?
Well, the UN Charter is pretty clear about what would constitute a war, an attack carried out in self-defense. There would have to be a really imminent threat of the target country being about to attack the attacker. And that is clearly not the case here. And they're, even the US are very half-heartedly making the claim. So this would not pass muster under the UN Charter, under the UN rules. This is a war of aggression, a war of choice, which may explain why Trump has been so keen on the border peace, which sort of recreates a mini security council with members who are one way or another in hock to him, owe him something, and one in which he's in charge. He decides who's a member and who gets to vote, and he decides the rules and makes them up as he goes along.
Even within the US, things haven't gone the way that they're supposed to. I mean, US Congress is supposed to approve wars.
Yes. I mean, under the Constitution, it's very clear that it is the right of Congress to decide whether or not the US goes to war. Now, previous presidents have, on the whole, sidestepped that using a variety of devices. But what is different this time is this is a big war. It's a war of regime change, most reminiscent, of course, of the 2003 Iraq invasion. And then on that occasion, President George Bush, the younger, made sure he had congressional backing and tried to get UN backing and got one UN resolution backing him and failed to get another, but at least made the attempt to shape public opinion, bring Congress aboard and the UN. I mean, we knew soon after that there were a lot of lies involved in that making that case, but he did make a case. The difference with Trump and his administration is they're not even bothering to make a case, really, that present any evidence to show any kind of imminent threat. And, of course, it was Trump himself who claimed after the June attack on Iran that the nuclear program had been obliterated. And at the same time, they are trying to make the argument, but it is now an imminent threat. So they do give the impression they're not really bothered about making a coherent case. But the price of that may be in not bringing the US public with them. A new poll shows that about a quarter of the public support this because he, after all, came in and sold himself as being the president that was going to end all the wars.
I mean, in that sense, is that the only consequence that Donald Trump might face at the ballot box?
Well, I think, yes, that would be the consequence that he's likely to face that he most cares about. But as it looks more and more that he will lose or the Republican Party will lose in November, he is taking more and more steps to try and avoid that in terms of being able to control the vote. And if he continues to hemorrhage support, one can only imagine and predict that those efforts to fix the vote, to fix the environment which the vote takes place, those efforts will only get more intense.
We'll be right back. The strikes are expected to continue for now. But what do you think is going to happen next? How much worse could this get? Could it blow out into more of a conflict? Or could there be pressure for a tamping down and some sort of talks happening?
I think, as ever with Donald Trump, everything is possible. He has said to The Atlantic magazine today that he was up for talks with the new and surviving leadership. So that is an option. It's also possible, and Netanyahu has said that he's going to intensify, Israel's going to intensify its strikes. I think a lot will depend on how successful Iran is in fighting back. Up to now, only very few Iranian missiles have got through to their intended targets. The death toll, certainly compared to the death toll in Iran, is very small, but they really only have to get through once to make a big impact. And what if they were to manage to hit, as their allies, the Houthis, almost did, a U.S. battleship or a U.S. destroyer? That would completely change the complexion of this conflict, certainly as seen from the point of view of the U.S. electorate. So there are wild cards that are out there that could completely change this, and it makes it very difficult to predict its trajectory.
The U.S. has wanted regime change for 47 years. They've had this ongoing conflict with Iran politically. When you step back, what do you see with this? What's your enduring impression of where this could be headed, especially when it comes to the future of the current regime in Iran?
I think it is hard to envisage a transition to some Western friendly, stable government. I think it is more likely that some other part of the regime comes to the fore, like the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guards. It's also very easy to imagine regime breakdown, partial breakdown that leads to a chaotic situation with minorities, separatists, opposition groups, supporters of the monarchy fighting for control, and a very bloody situation as we witnessed in Libya and in Syria. It is possible to imagine a situation far, far worse than the current regime, although the current regime is a terrible and murderous regime.
Julian, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
That was senior international correspondent Julian Borger. This episode was produced by Miles Herbert and Joe Koning, who also did the sound design and mixing. The executive producer of Full Story is Hannah Parks. Don't forget to follow Full Story wherever you get your podcasts, including on Spotify. I'm Regid Ahmed. See you soon.